Welcome to the Back 9 Report, presented by eDraft.com.
Hello, and welcome to this week's edition of eDraft.com's Back 9 Report. We come online every Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time and check in on the world of golf to bring you the latest news, insights, analysis, along with recaps, previews, interviews. Hey, we talk anything and everything golf. My name is Carlos Torres. Like every week, I'm alongside my co-host, Fred Valvader. Fred, hi, how are you today?
Hey, Carlos and fellow golfaholics. I am fantastic. We had a beautiful, beautiful day today in Toledo, Ohio. And we got a lot of golf to talk about. Billy Horschel got it done at Cherry Hills in the BMW Championship. Why did Phil Mickelson and Keegan Bradley both withdraw last week? And the last major championship of the year is this week in France on the LPGA Tour. And someone is going to win $10 million this week at the Tour Championship. Let's go.
Let's go. A lot of money is going to be given away this weekend, but let's not get started. You mentioned those withdrawals. That's going to be our theme of the week. We certainly have something for the players today, so you don't want to miss that. And we have our interview, our very important guest of the week, our VIG, so returning interview. Very excited to have Steve Mona. He's the Chief Executive Officer of the World Golf Foundation, so he's going to be back. He's going to be around the 30 minutes past the hour. So let's go right away with the Par 5 news, but before we start that, we have to give our condolences to Sir Nick Faldo, who lost his dad today, and he tweeted there, 18 holes of life, that miss, extra holes by Wester, this PM, passed peacefully on the 9th, 2014. That means two nines and 14 clubs. Thanks all for your love. So, Sir Nick Faldo, our condolences here from the Backman Report, Fred and I, for you.
Yeah, Carlos, we certainly want to wish them the best. There was some good news for Sir Nick today. It was announced that he will be awarded the Payne Stewart Award, which is presented by the Southern Company. This is a pretty big deal for the players. Some really big names have won this. It's been around. It began in 2000 after the tragic death of Payne Stewart in 1999. Past winners include Peter Jacobs and Steve Stricker, David Toms, Tom Lehman, Kenny Perry, Davis Love, Hal Sutton, Gary Player. You've got Ben Crenshaw, Nick Price, Brad Faxon, Jay Haas, Tom Watson, Nicklaus and Palmer, and Byron Nelson. So the really greats of the game that have been have given great contributions and been great sportsmen and gentlemen in the game of golf. It's very meaningful, very meaningful, and a prestigious award for the players. So, Nick Faldo was number one in the world for over 100 weeks. He did have the several major wins. He was on 11 Ryder Cup teams, and he captained the 1998 European Ryder Cup team. He's been on CBS and Golf Channel's lead golf analyst for several years. He's done designed over 27 golf courses around the world. But most importantly, probably what he's going to be known for is his Faldo series of junior tournaments all around the world. It's grown to 40 events in over 30 countries with over 70,000 juniors participating, both boys and girls. And should be noted that coming out of that program have been two world number ones, Rory McIlroy and Yanni Tsang. Both came up through the Faldo series as juniors. So we want to wish him the best in this hour. I know that's a difficult time for them. But this was a great award that was given to Nick Faldo today.
So that's very good news. So I believe you also have something about some Hall of Fame for the caddies, which I still don't understand. So do you have something about that?
I do. Carlos, you already know this, but There is a Caddy Hall of Fame, and it was started by the Professional Caddies Association in 1999 and has been administered by the Western Golf Association since 2011. Members of that first class back in 1999 included Angelo Argea, our longtime caddy for Jack Nicklaus, the white bushy hair and always smoking a cigarette, Augusta National Golf Club caddy Carl Jackson, who had two Masters wins with Ben Crenshaw, Mike Fluff Cowan, who toted for Peter Jacobson, Tiger Woods and Jim Furyk, Lee Trevino's caddy Herman Mitchell, Squeaky Medlin, who was the longtime caddy for Nick Price and was with John Daly when he won the PGA Championship. Both Francis Ouimet and his caddy, Eddie Lauer, were inducted in that first class, along with, of course, Chick Evans, who started the Evans Scholars Fund to provide college scholarships for caddies. The newest member of the Caddy Hall of Fame is Steve Williams. He was inducted last Wednesday prior to the BMW Championship at Cherry Hills and is also run by the Western Golf Association. Williams was on the bag for 13 of Tiger Woods' 14 major championships and helped Adam Scott win the 2011 WGC Bridgestone and the 2013 Masters. On the bag for 14 major championship wins is the most by any caddy. The Western Golf Association honored Williams for his contribution in promoting caddies and their role in the game of golf. Williams started caddying at the age of 10 and has said he planned to curtail his duties in 2015. In the interim, he will have handed the clubs to Greg Norman and Raymond Floyd in addition to Woods and Scott. Always intense, committed, and sometimes controversial, Williams always demanded and got the best from his guy. He is probably the most recognizable and respected caddy in the yard. We here at the Back Nine appreciate the hard work caddies do at the back do, and one of the questions we have debated over the last year is, should caddies be included into the World Golf Hall of Fame? Not just the Caddy Hall of Fame, but the World Golf Hall of Fame. We're going to ask Steve Mona about that later this evening. Here are a couple of interviews we taped from well-known and respected golf writers, Jaime Diaz and Bill Fields, about that very question, should caddies have a spot or category in the World Golf Hall of Fame?
Let's start with Bill Fields.
We're here with Bill Fields at the Senior PGA Championship in at Harbor Shores in Benton Harbor, Michigan. And I'm just going to take he's been in the game. He's been a golf writer for over 20 years for Golf World and various publications. And we're going to ask him a couple tough questions here about the Hall of Fame and just get his feelings. And from being around the game for 20 or 30 years, what his thoughts are. And the first question, Bill, is given Kenny Perry's record in the Senior Tour with no major wins, he had a couple runners-up, he did have 14 wins, 10 runner-ups, he won over $30 million, you know, but now on the Senior Tour or the Champions Tour, all of a sudden he's won three majors. Do you feel like that affects his qualification or his chance of getting in the World Golf Hall of Fame?
Well, I think it could. I think with the recent restructuring at the Hall of Fame, which certainly has had a bit of a checkered history since it began almost 40 years ago in September in Pinehurst, my home area. I think it's been a bit controversial. I think the real thing to consider is that there's two ways the Hall of Fame could have gone when it started. It could have simply let in the very, very best players, which it really did early on in the original class. I believe it was 13 players like Palmer, Nicklaus, Player, the very, you know, Mickey Wright, the very elite players. But then over the years, more people were let in under different sort of categories, even if they weren't delineated as such. Golf World founder Bob Harlow, who was a former tour promoter who helped build the tour as we came to know it, he's in. So unlike Cooperstown, where there and other halls of fame where there are certain distinctive categories, golf's always had sort of one big bowl that everybody goes in. And I'm one that thinks that what a player does after he turns 50, perhaps it's a little bit tempered by having covered the Champions Tour for a long time, as well as covering regular golf, that I think it should matter. I think it should make an impact. Hale Irwin, for instance, he would have been in the Hall of Fame anyway, and he was inducted in 1992 before he turned 50 years old. But what he's done out on the Senior Tour, winning 45 times you know, 16 more times than second place Lee Trevino. It's just incredible. And I don't think that that type of performance should be overlooked. And Kenny Perry, if he builds a strong Champions Tour career, he certainly should be considered.
This one might be a little bit more difficult, and this is kind of near and dear to my heart, actually. But, you know, with Tiger Woods holding the number one spot for over 13 years in his career, and for most of that time, Steve Williams was his caddy. And, of course, we all know about Tiger firing him, and then he's jumped over to Adam Scott's bag, and lo and behold, Adam has ascended to the number one player in the world. Where does a caddy fit in as a candidate for the World Golf Hall of Fame? Do you ever see that happening?
I think it's possible. I don't know if it's probable. I think the first caddy that would get in, and I think there's been some movement to get him in, would be Eddie Lowry, who caddied for Francis Ouimet in 1913, and later had a bit of a career, you know, in golf, but not as a player, but as a person who was around the game. I think caddies in the modern age, they certainly do a lot. Are they Hall of Fame worthy? I don't know. Steve Williams, one of the best at his craft. He's, if not the best, he's right up there. And no doubt he's helped Tiger Woods along the way. I think particularly of the putt that Tiger Woods made on the 71st hole at the 1999 PGA, where Tiger Woods very definitely credited Steve Williams for helping him read that 7 or 8 footer for par. So modern caddies, I'm friends with some of them. They do a great job. But if you look back at the wider scope of the game, for many years, caddies were not that important. They were just bag toters, and great players still played great golf without them. So things have evolved. I don't know if I'd be the first to jump on voting in Steve Williams into the Hall of Fame, but you know, somebody could make a logical case. I guess I'd certainly listen to it.
Well, thank you, Bill, again for your time, and we look forward to reading some more of your articles in Golf World and as we go along.
Thank you for having me on, Fred. I appreciate it.
That was the interview with Bill Fields. Let's go now for the one from Jaime Diaz.
We're here at the Memorial Tournament with Jaime Diaz, and we're going to ask him a question. We've kind of been asking people an issue we've been talking about, and it's a little bit about the World Golf Hall of Fame. Now that Kenny Perry has won his three majors on the senior tour, on the Champions Tour, he wasn't able to get the job done on the regular tour, but he had a great career. Does this change his chances of possibly getting into the World Golf Hall of Fame, you think?
Well, you know, the World Golf Hall of Fame has set up a criteria now that I think requires 15 victories minimum on the PGA Tour.
And two majors.
And, of course, Kenny didn't have that on the regular tour. I personally am against all criteria that's numerical tournaments. I feel like it's about how good a player was the guy. I mean, Kenny Perry should have won the Masters. Kenny Perry should have won the PGA. He could very easily have two majors. He didn't do it, okay, I get it. But to me, he's a great player. You know, now Kenny has three majors on the Champions Tour, and they don't really even count Champions Tour stuff for Hall of Fame criteria. To me, it's about the full breadth of a player's career. And I feel like cumulatively and just anecdotally, Kenny Perry is a really fine player who, in my opinion, has a good argument to be, not that he's going to make it because he's a very modest guy, to be in the Hall of Fame. And I say it for two reasons. Number one, I have great appreciation for guys who don't happen to have won but contended a lot. I don't think it should always be about the victory. It should be about your impact on these major champions. I mean, Doug Sanders won 20 times. He never won a major. He was in the hunt 7 or 8 times within 2 or 3 strokes of winning majors. He never did it. To me, he's a Hall of Famer.
And he did wonders for the bright clothes sales.
Well, he did. And he's a popular player who popularized golf, who was a fan favorite, who was great with people. I mean, to me, that's important, too. It's about fame, the Hall of Fame. It's not the Hall of Performance, although performance matters. I'm not trying to take that away. But I really feel like if they got rid of the criteria for numerical tournaments, you could use people's entire impact. Like Peter Allis goes in the Hall of Fame. First of all, that was one of the great speeches and one of the great moments the Hall of Fame's ever had. You know, when you put just players in there, I'm not saying all players are dull, but they don't tend to have the greatest speeches, especially young players. You know, like Phil Mickelson going in. They're ambivalent about going in. Ernie Els going in at 41 years old. When Dan Jenkins got, you know, he's 80, and he's not even a player. He's a sports writer. But it was a great moment. And to me, he's a Hall of Famer, because if you talk to anybody who loves golf, Dan Jenkins is at the forefront of their experience in golf. And that's really what it's about to me. Not to say that you know, in any way cheapen the performance part of it. No, you value it. But I think putting numbers on it limits it. And the other part that I was going to say is we're running out of players. You know, golf doesn't have a huge, like baseball and football and basketball, they have teams. You know, any given year there's 500 players in the league. Golf has, you know, 80 credible players every year who are actually, you know, contenders who win. I mean, I know you have the money list, 125. You know, there just aren't that many players who have won more than 10 tournaments. It's probably, I'll bet there's fewer than 50 out there right now who aren't in the Hall of Fame who've won 10 tournaments or more, and probably fewer than that. And so where are all these players going to come from? Because the new players are not winning at the same rate. You're not seeing guys rack up 25 win careers, and I think that's going to be really rare. So you need a pool to pull from, and I think it's better to be open-minded about who you let in. I think Kenny Perry would be a very good addition to the Hall of Fame, and I think Jim Furyk should be in the Hall of Fame. He's on the borderline right now. Steve Stricker's close, you know, no major, but very good career. I think Mark O'Meara definitely should be in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
Two majors, a U.S. amateur. You know, so I think, for example, the LPGA made a big mistake setting a very hard line at a very high bar, 30 wins, or a combination of, I think, 27 wins and majors.
So many majors, yeah.
And, you know, if you just look at who's out there now, nobody's going to get to 30 wins. It's not going to happen.
Laura Davies has 45 wins in Europe and 20-some wins in the United States and is not in the Hall of Fame.
Laura Davies is a perfect example. You know, Amy Alcott was stuck on 29 forever, and she played past what she wanted to play to try to get that last number. Just to get in the Hall of Fame, they just said, hey, you're a Hall of Famer, because she clearly is. But 29 is not 30, and, you know, I think they want to put the same ethos on it that they do in golf. You know, it's like, you know, you lose by a stroke, you lost. Well, I don't think it's like that in the Hall of Fame. I think it's about somebody's impact and what people think of them. That's what it is a subjective. It shouldn't be a totally objective, in my opinion, measure. So, Laura Davies, come on, got to be in the Hall of Fame. And what'd she win? 27 on the LPGA Tour.
20 something. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean.
Yeah.
So
part time, playing part time.
Well, you know, she's a great underachiever. She should have been a lot better, but that's not here or there. She was a famous player. She made a huge impact. You know, she was somebody who everybody knew who followed golf.
And they absolutely love her in Europe. I mean, she is a hero over there.
Well, she's an iconic player. I mean, no woman has ever been as physically imposing and gifted athletically as she has. I mean, she's just so strong and big. She hits the ball so far. And, you know, even to me, John Daly should be in the Hall of Fame. It's close. Now, I know, but, you know, two majors and, you know, a Bunyan-esque figure in the game, an important figure in the game. So I'd like to see the Hall of Fame expanded. Maybe I'm taking it a little far, but I definitely think it should be liberalized beyond what it is right now. And they just reformed it. So actually I'm a little disappointed that probably any change that's going to happen again probably won't be for a while.
Well, they do have the selection committee. So, you know, they might, you know, like a Kenny Perry, a Laura Davies, they might come up
through
that.
There's a lot of guys in line for that. You got to wait. They'll only do one at a time. You know, it'll take a long time for Kenny Perry to get in that way.
Changing tack here just a little bit, one other thing with the Hall of Fame that we're kind of talking about, too, is, you know, where do caddies come in? You know, and this comes up because of Stevie Williams. Tiger was number one for over 13 years with most of that time Stevie was on his bag. He jumps over to Adam Scott's bag, and lo and behold, within a year, he's back up to number one. Where does the importance of the caddy come in? Do you see possibly a caddy section ever at the Hall of Fame? You know, or are they just the hired guy and you know, not gonna, no chance?
Well, I there is a caddy Hall of Fame that they've done independently, and a lot of guys are in it, and it's, you know, it's well attended among the caddies, and they're very thankful for it. I think it just gets to that point where there are certain iconic figures who, whatever they are, should be in the Hall of Fame. Peter Allis is one. Peter Allis was a great player, by the way, but not a Hall of Fame player. but his impact as a commentator. And Dan Jenkins is a great sports writer. He's sort of a one-off. Herb Wynn's in the Hall of Fame. Bernard Darwin's in the Hall of Fame. From whatever discipline, maybe there's one or two who just stand out because they're just so exceptional and they become household names. And Steve Williams probably has the greatest credentials of any caddy. I mean, starting with Peter Thompson as a kid and then graduating to a lot of great players, Greg Norman and Raymond Floyd and, of course, Tiger and now Adam Scott. And Steve is, you know, I don't know how you measure a caddy, but he looks like a hell of a good caddy. In other words, there's something about his body language and the way he relates to his player that gets them to play better. And that's really what it's all about for a caddy. You know, are you a good partner out there? Do you bring the best out in your player? Do you do the right thing for his well-being? And it's impossible to quantify it, impossible. Because, you know, we've had great caddies out here who've had a sick week and the player's sister has filled in and they won. So, I mean, how do you measure it? But I think if there were any caddies in there,
There'd be some great caddies.
I mean, Eddie Lowry. There's a movement to put Eddie Lowry in because of his, just because of his moment with Francis. We met. He ended up being a very important person in golf, besides obviously what he did with We Met. But then there's, Dave Musgrove won many majors with various players. But I would say Steve Williams has crossed over and become, you know, kind of a sports figure. You know, and to me, if anybody's going to be a caddy in the Hall of Fame, I'd say Steve Williams, and I don't think it's a bad precedent. To me, he's a special person in golf.
Well, again, we want to thank you for taking the time and giving us your thoughts on that. It's just kind of a topic that we keep kicking around here on Back Nine Report. And, again, all the best to you, and thanks again.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. See you, bud.
That is definitely a hot topic, and we could expand on that, and we certainly will. And like Fred said, we're going to be asking Steve Mullen about it, so we'll take that again. So let's continue right now with the Par 5 news, and let me talk about Min-Jae Lee, who we have been following all year. She turned professional, so that emerging golf superstar that is Min-Jae Lee turned professional just a day after leading Australia to that sensational comeback victory in the Women's World Amateur Team Championship. She's just 18 years old. She's the world's number one amateur, and she announced that she will tee it up as a pro for the first time in the year's final women's major, the Evian Championship in France this week. And so we're going to be talking about that a little bit later on. She made the announcement in a lighthearted video with the Fremantle Dockers club captain Matthew Pavlich. There was definitely little left for Lee to achieve in amateur ranks. She got that 7-stroke deficit in the Amateur Cup right now in Australia to win over Canada and Japan on Saturday. So it was a record setting. She has won back-to-back Australian amateur titles. She was definitely ready to go to the pros. She won earlier also the Victorian Open in Australia. So she's definitely ready. So we look forward for her professional career. So congratulations for Min-Jae Lee, long time coming. And another good news is that Michelle Wee, it's been a little over a month since the LPGA fans last saw her in action, but a two-time winner this year will make her return to competition this weekend, also at the Evian Championship. Wee will be vying for her second major victory of the season after sitting out for 5 weeks due to a stress reaction in her right index finger. We last played at the Major LPGA Classic in early August, where she had to withdraw during the first round due to an injury. She currently leads, and this is very important, in the standings of the inaugural Rolex Annika Major Award with 84 points following her victory at the U.S. Women's Open and her runner-up finish at the Kraft Nabisco Championship. This award will honor the player who has the most outstanding record in the five major championships during a current LPGA Tour season, and in order to take home the award, a player must win one of those major championships. So very important for her to win this, and it's great to have Michelle Wee back in play. So, Fred, hey, tell us, there's another problem in Rio? I can't believe that. Is Fred with us? Fred apparently is not here with us right now, so let's see if we can get him back. Fred, it seems like there's problems in Rio, and there's problems also with Brett right now. So let's see if we can get him back. It was just a minute here, so I can try to erase this. Go anybody. Go away. What do you do? Fred. Breaking. Let's try to get Fred back immediately. Don't go away, anybody.
Thank you for listening to the Back 9 Report presented by eDraft.com. We'll be right back. Don't forget to check out our co-hosts on Twitter by clicking their names in the episode description. Now, back to the show.
We're back, and let's see, Fred, are you there now?
I am here. I kept going.
Finally,
so
we got you back. Yes.
Hey, you lost me?
There are problems with you, and there are problems with you as well. So what's going on, man?
So you want me to do, we'll go back to the Rio? Okay, I will.
I had finished the LPGA. I talked about Min Jae Lee and Michelle Lee, so I was just passing it on to you. I was saying, hey, there's problems in Rio, but apparently also in Toledo, so
I lost the end of the Jaime Diaz interview, the very end of it.
Okay.
And I was just gone, so I don't know what happened. But, okay, anyhow, there's a problem in Rio. There was a news item in this week's Global Golf Post that the Olympic golf course in Rio de Janeiro, under construction by Gil Hans, has encountered yet another snag. In this latest chapter, the Olympic golf course, a Rio court proposed Wednesday that the course should be modified to meet environmental concerns. Public prosecutors filed a lawsuit against the City of Rio and course developer Pasquale Morro. A judge said the defendants must return on September 17th to indicate whether proposed modifications are acceptable. Judge Eduardo Klausner urged the prosecutors to offer a proposal to preserve as much of the Atlantic rainforest as possible while accommodating the course construction. In the meantime, Klausner said course work can continue, but no additional areas of vegetation are to be plowed under. The report said the hearing was raucous and at times chaotic, and quoted a biologist hired by the developer as saying that because the course layout has been set, it would prove difficult to modify. The report also included recent quotes from International Golf Federation VP Ty Vopal about alternative plans for the Olympic tournament. Tim Finchem today in his press conference on the state of the PGA Tour did acknowledge this newest lawsuit, but he said it's really not a problem at this point. It's more of a red herring, kind of a much ado about nothing. Everything on the ground there is continuing. Everything's on schedule, and he is not concerned about it at this point in time. So let's hope so. It'd be nice to have a golf course for the 2016 Olympics. And Carlos, also in the news this week, we have an item, a really nice item here, about Billy Casper's world's largest golf outing. It has raised over $875,000, and it's more than just a great day of golf. It's about making a difference in the lives of injured servicemen and women through a charitable partner Wounded Warrior Project. Over 12,000 people played in the August 11th event at over 120 facilities around the United States. Factoring in the 2014 fundraising, the world's largest golf outing has raised nearly $2 million for the Wounded Warrior Project in its four-year history. Adam Silva, Chief Development Officer of the Wounded Warrior Project, said, "We are deeply moved by the outpouring of support from golfers and veterans alike. We salute Billy Casper Golf for its altruistic culture and presenting this massive event with tremendous precision and professionalism." Billy Casper Golf Chairman and CEO Peter Hill said, "Our nation's generosity and the growth of the world's largest golf outing are amazing. It's humbling to witness the unwavering appreciation for our brave troops whose sacrifices protect and preserve our daily freedoms. Carlos, this is truly a worthy event and one that we wholeheartedly promote. Contributions can still be made to the Wounded Warrior Project at worldslargestgolfouting.com. That's worldslargestgolfouting.com. golfoutings.com. There's a little button there that you can click on to make a donation. It also has the running total. When I looked at it today, it was actually up over $885,000 from this year's contributions. So anybody that would like to contribute $5, $10, $20, please click on to worldslargestgolfouting.com and do that. Carlos, that wraps up the news items for me this evening. Do we have Steve on the phone?
No, not yet, but I still have the European tour that is returning to India, and that is because officials said last Friday that the Indian Open, which skipped an edition in 2014, will be jointly sanctioned by the Asian Tour and European Tour next year. The tournament has been sanctioned solely by the Asian Tour and has been played since 1964 and had been held for several years at the Delhi Golf Club. This event is scheduled to take place from February 19th to the 22nd next year and will carry a purse of $1.5 million, okay, million dollars. The venue will be announced soon. It hasn't been, as I said, it has been held for several years at the Delhi Golf Club. The championship will be promoted by Nimbus Sports, which has extended its partnership with the Indian Golf Union to manage and promote the Indian Open the next 3 years. The tournament will also form part of the annual Race to Dubai, and with this, it will offer the chance for Indian golfing talents to compete against many of the top players from both tours, which began to co-sanction tournaments together in Asia since 1999. But I have to say, this is a great thing for the development of golf in India. And like Rayan Irani, the president of the Golf Union, said, this co-sanction really raises the bar for the tournament and will only be on every local and area golfer's wish list to win that tournament, which has been the pride and joy of the ITU for the past 50 years. So definitely great to see every time that there's development in any country, and great looking forward to see the European Tour going to India next year. And we have now our VIG, our very important guest of the week, Steve Moniz, with us. So let's take a quick short break, and when we come back, we'll have that great interview for you. Don't go away.
Thank you for listening. We'll be right back. In the meantime, don't forget to visit www.edraft.com for analysis, breaking news, and more. Also, remember to follow us on Twitter at edraftsports and on Facebook at facebook.com/edraftsports. Now, back to the show.
And we're back, and now it's time for our VIG of the week, our very important guest, the interview. It's a returning interview. Last time we had him was last year. Is Steve Moore. He's the chief executive officer of the World Golf Foundation, and that's one of the interviews that you remember because of all the great info, the great insight that he brings. So we want to welcome him back, and thank you, Steve, for being with us and taking some time off your very busy schedule for this interview. How are you today, Steve?
Doing very well, Fred. Thanks for having me on this evening, and it's a pleasure to be with you again.
Hey, Steve. I'll echo Carlos's welcome back, and thanks for talking to us. And, hey, your board members are some of the biggest golf executives in the world. What do you feel is the state of the economy in the golf industry today?
Well, I think it's in reasonably good shape overall. If you look at golf holistically, it's actually quite strong. And we've seen a lot of media coverage about certain elements of the industry. Obviously, facilities have been closing at a higher rate in which they've been opening. But that's actually just a function of supply and demand. And our total number of golfers has been holding steady at about 25 million, so there's been a lot written about that. But in fact, the golf industry, if you look at it more broadly, is doing quite well. If you look at how well the organizations that are overseeing the major events of our industry, you look at the USGA, for instance, and they recently signed a new deal with Fox to televise the U.S. Open, and the terms were not disclosed, but it was reported to over $1 billion for 12 years. You look at the PGA of America, and they just renegotiated a deal with NBC to televise the Ryder Cup. Terms weren't disclosed for that, but you can be quite sure that that was for a record amount. Then you look at the PGA Tour having a record year last year in terms of the size of the overall purses that the players played for, that the amount of money that was donated to charity, the number of events. You look at the LPGA Tour, same thing. So golf in a lot of dimensions is actually doing quite well. So if I were to give it an overall grade, I would give it a very solid grade. Not all elements are at their all-time peak, but it's unrealistic to think it would be that way at all times. But all in all, we have a very solid game and a very solid industry.
Yeah, we've had Craig Kann from the LPGA Tour on the show, and sponsorship participation is at an all-time high for them. They are constantly looking at new sponsors coming to the fore and new areas. Same thing, we talked to Bill Kalfi last week on the web.com tour. They're looking at going into new markets and with sponsors coming on board for their tournaments. And also the dollars that go to charity from all these tournaments, $2 billion on the PGA Tour, but let's factor in also the web.com, the Champions Tour, and LPGA and everything. I mean, it's truly a big number. We saw the thing, you kind of mentioned it, the Brian Gumbel piece, HBO Real Sports a few weeks ago, that painted a fairly ugly future for the game of golf in the U.S. Golf courses closing, less golf enthusiasts, especially among women and young men taking up the game. The game takes too much time. It's far too expensive to play for the average American. So you're saying this really isn't a fair assessment. This might be just a bit overblown for TV.
Well, here's what I would say. Just like any other recreational pursuit in the modern time in which we live, we have challenges that we have to address. There's no question about it. And the three that are most prominent in golf are those of time, expense, and difficulty of the game. But they're not insurmountable, number one. And number two, actually, if you look at golf and if you dissect it a little bit more and you really examine the numbers, some of what gets reported isn't exactly the reality of the situation. For instance, women represent about 20% of the golf population, but 260,000 women joined the game last year. And if you look at our adult player development program, which is called Get Golf Ready, the number one group in terms of participants in that program are women. In fact, about 60% of the participants in Get Golf Ready are women. So that bodes well for participation among women in the game. You talk about millennials, and there's a lot that's been said about millennials aren't taking the game, et cetera, but that's really not the case. 25% of participants in golf are of the millennial generation. So that's a quarter of, obviously, the 25 million number. So that's a little north of 6 million participants are millennials. What's even more encouraging...
25% are millennials of the 25 million. That's a big number.
That's correct. It's over 6 million people. In addition to that, and the statistic I like even better than that statistic is that for every one millennial that plays the game, two wish to play the game. And really what it boils down to for the millennial generation is that it's purely a case of their economic situation has not allowed them, in all cases, to participate in the game the way that they wish to. And we're all well familiar with the student loan debt and the either unemployment or underemployment of the millennial generation as created in large measure by the Great Recession. So there are macro societal issues at play here as well. So my general statement is I'm not at all whitewashing some of the issues that we have to address as a game. There's no question about it. But we're really much healthier than gets portrayed often, and number one. And number two, I believe our future is bright because golf is an aspirational game. It's a game that people want to play, and they want to be part of the golf lifestyle. It's not for everybody. Certainly for a certain segment of our population, it's a very attractive game. So I'm bullish on the future of golf.
Today in his State of the PGA Tour address, PGA Tour Commissioner Tim Finchin mentioned enhanced collaboration. What can you tell us about that initiative?
Well, I've been very close to that because Tim is chair of the World Golf Foundation board this year, and his stated goal was to see greater coordination and collaboration among the governing bodies of golf in the U.S. And so since April, actually, we've been hard at work at a couple of things, and I'll mention really three here very briefly. One is, and we'll be making announcements on this after the Ryder Cup, but essentially we're going to focus on a limited number of initiatives that we feel give us the best chance to achieve success as an industry in terms of bringing people into the game. And what we've been guilty of, frankly, in the past is, for all the right reasons, we've engaged and initiated a number of initiatives, and sometimes we've created diffusion and maybe confusion in the marketplace. So we're going to focus on a small number, and we're all going to get behind those. That's number one. Number two, we're going to create a calendar, essentially, during the year, during which we will promote various of the initiatives, depending upon the time of year and which initiative is most applicable to be promoted at that time of year. And number three, we're going to create an industry-wide communications plan to help us coordinate the general messaging about the game so that all of the major bodies in golf are coordinated and of one mind in terms of how we're talking about the game and what we're wishing to communicate about the game. So I'm glad to hear that Tim mentioned that, and it's certainly been something that we've put a lot of emphasis and energy around this year.
That sounds really good. He went on to add, you know, there are some concerns, of course. You know, it's a wide industry. So the economy downturn from 2007-2008, of course, has had a big impact, you know, with less income, so less dollars available to pay green fees and time spent on the golf course, those kind of things. But we're seem to be coming out of that at this point. One of the things that maybe hasn't rebounded, of course, is the housing industry. And, you know, it grew at a fantastic rate for 40 years, and it's just not recovering as fast as the general economy. But, again, that's kind of a small piece of the puzzle. He also said that kind of the noise or the media conception is not really consistent with the reality. There are real signs of growth and interest, and that's pretty much what you're telling us here this evening.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I mentioned the millennials, I mentioned women. Those are two groups that often get described as not having a lot of interest in the game, but that's really not the case. But let me just make this comment. We believe that golf, in order for it to reach its full potential as a sport and an industry, needs to look like America looks. And we're very much focused on ensuring that occurs to the extent that we can influence that. So what does that mean? Well, we want golf to look like America looks from the standpoint of gender participation. We want it to look like America looks from the standpoint of ethnic participation, from age participation, from disabled individuals participation, et cetera. So our view is if golf can look like America looks, if it can just be a microcosm, a snapshot, if you will, of America, then we'll reach our true potential, whatever that might be. And that's really an overriding goal of ours. We want to make it as accessible and affordable as possible. And in fact, on that dimension, a lot of people overlook the fact that 80% of golf today is played on golf courses open to the public. And the median green fee, that's median, not average, but the median green fee in the United States is $28. So a lot of the perception that people have about golf being a game for the elites just simply doesn't square with the facts. But we have to do a better job of communicating that and changing the way in which golf's perceived.
Yeah, those are two really good numbers. Along that line, You know, Gumbel made a point of pointing out a couple closed golf courses, and there are those in pretty much every community. And I know, you know, I'm in Toledo, Ohio. We've got 7 private country clubs here in town, and, you know, the town just probably isn't big enough to support 7 private country clubs yet. But so some of those are probably going to get sorted out. And although Nicklaus and Palmer, Norman and Fazio maybe haven't been building many new courses in the U.S., Tom Doak, Corin Crenshaw, Gil Hans, and Pete Dye is involved in a new project by Herb Kohler in Sheboygan, Wisconsin for his American club. Mike Kaiser keeps building courses, Bannon Dunes, Cabin Links. He's looking at 2 courses in Sand Hills in Wisconsin. Tiger Woods is preparing to open a new course in Houston. So there are new courses being built. They're just not maybe some of the old guard names that we're used to seeing, and they're not courses being made for PGA tournament play. They're courses being made for the average golfer to play.
Yeah, several good points there. First of all, what we're seeing, and it's been occurring now for the last 7 years, is just a natural correction in supply and demand. We did get overbuilt. There's no question about it. So just like any other industry, across the country, we have to settle into the right mix between supply and demand, and that's what's happening. So that's point number one. Point number two is, as you pointed out, the new construction in this country is very limited. I mean, it's 10 or 15 facilities a year, number one. Number two, they don't tend to be real estate-driven as they were, say, in the 90s and the early 2000s, and then we had the bubble burst in 2007, 2008, that time period. So you're seeing very little of that. So what you're seeing, and you mentioned several of the others, you mentioned Mike Kaiser, you mentioned Herb Kohler. These are not real estate developments. This is pure golf. So it's a little bit of a different approach. And so really what I describe it as, it's just a normalizing of our industry. And so it's really healthy in the long term. And so my view is that you're going to continue to see this occur for several more years. You're going to continue to see more courses close than open, which is fine. And you're going to see, shall I say, more of these, for lack of a better term, specialized golf courses that are not necessarily real estate driven and don't necessarily have to have the biggest name architects attached to them. Because that's what drove real estate sales formerly. So I think all in all, it's healthy for the game, no question about it. And 20 years down the road, we're all of us in the game, and hopefully we'll all still be in it. We'll be glad we went through this period of time.
You mentioned, about the tours that are covered on TV, and Fincham also made a strong point about the multitude of hours that golf is on TV, Golf Channel 24/7, PGA Tour, LPGA, Championship, Web.com, European. They beam images from golf courses around the world. This has to be helping grow the game and generate a whole new crop of golf fans in the United States as well as the world in general.
That's right. If you look at golf viewership, about 50% of people who watch golf on TV don't play the game. And, of course, we want to see a greater conversion. We want to see more people who are fans of the game play the game. And certainly that also applies to people who go out to live golf tournaments. The percentage is higher in terms of those that play. But there's still a certain percentage of people who go out because it's an event, because it's a happening. And so, therefore, it gives us a tremendous opportunity to reach people, to introduce them to our sport, who are interested in it and who are fans of it. So the PGA Tour's done a tremendous job, as have all the other tours that you've mentioned, to create a really compelling TV product. And there's a debate within golf about whether the tours, which would be described as the entertainment side of golf, are independent or interdependent on the facility side of the game, the actual playing of the game. I think it's a little bit of both. But the fact is, our view is that if golf can continue to have a high profile, if it can continue to be televised as it is worldwide, that ultimately is good for the game because it gets people interested in the game. If they stay fans forever, that's fine. We'd like to convert them over and move them from people who watch on TV to come out to live events, and then from live events to actually try the game, and we think we'll get our fair share of that. Because, again, as I said earlier, golf is aspirational. People want to be part of it because it represents a certain lifestyle, and it's something that in which they wish to engage. And so we just need to capitalize on that.
Steve, I got one more question to ask you before I let you go tonight, unless Carlos has a question here a little bit. But I've got kind of a pet project going on, and we've had I've talked to several people through the year, and we had a couple interviews. We ran a couple of interviews earlier in the show, but we had a news piece earlier that Steve Williams was inducted into the Caddy Hall of Fame. We've debated this past year whether or not Caddy should be inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame. And the World Golf Foundation is being the keeper of the World Golf Hall of Fame. Could you tell us if there's ever been any consideration for caddies being inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame, or your personal feelings on that subject?
Well, let me first address it more broadly. First of all, caddies are eligible for induction into the World Golf Hall of Fame. We have a category which is called Lifetime Achievement. It's one of four ways in which someone can become a member of the Hall of Fame, and those are for people who have made their mark in golf as a non-player, if you will. So people who are administrators, people like Dean Beeman, he also played, but he came in under Lifetime Achievement. Pete Dye, for instance, would be another example. So there is an avenue available for caddies. That's number one. Number two, yes, there has been discussion about caddies becoming members of the Hall of Fame. We have a saying at the World Golf Hall of Fame, and that is, it's not no, it's not yet. So my view is, you ask me my personal view, I think someday there will be. What that day is, I don't know. But one thing that's important to me is never to say never. So if the caddies as a profession continue to be a prominent part of the game, which they are now, and they go all the way back, by the way, to the days of Eddie Lowry. If you remember, he caddied for Francis we met in the U.S. Open, and actually he's a person whose name has been mentioned. And so my view is it will happen. When, I don't know, but I think it's more a case of when, not if.
Well, Carlos, you heard it from the guy who knows right here. He's got his finger on the pulse of the golf economy. It's a $70 billion industry, employs a lot of people, generates a lot of dollars for charity, and golf is not nearly in as bad a shape as one Mr. Brian Gumbel would like to infer.
No, I really am happy to hear that, and I'm happy to hear, Fred, that your pet project is about when and not if, so keep it, be happy about it, okay? Hey, Steve, I would like to ask you a question. Maybe it's a double question before I let you go. You mentioned about two things that catches my mind right now, and it's one thing is that we got to improve how golf is perceived because, as you were mentioning and Fred was mentioning, there are some numbers out there and people talking, and really that's not the truth about it. And the other one is that we got to get a bigger conversion from those people that see golf that do not play into becoming practitioners. Which initiatives would you see right now, or have you been analyzing to implement, maybe short term, to try to get those things fixed, if you will?
Sure. Well, let me speak to the second issue first about conversion. The program that has shown the most promise is Get Golf Ready. Get Golf Ready is an adult player development initiative. It offers adults a clear pathway into the game. It's very simple. It's five lessons, $99. Those are group lessons in groups of no more than eight. If you go through the Get Golf Ready program, after year one, our retention rate is over 80%. And after 5 years, it diminishes only to 60%, meaning if you went through the program 5 years later, six will still be in the game. And those retention numbers are significantly higher than any other program that exists in golf. So that really speaks to the conversion piece. We just need to do a better job of scaling up Get Golf Ready. It's in about 4,500 facilities across the country. About close to 100,000 people will graduate from the program this year. But we have to take that number up to, say, 300,000, 400,000, 500,000 in a year. So we have a lot of work to do there, but it does work. So that speaks to the conversion piece. To the perception piece, I think it really boils down to just reciting the facts about the game. And I've always been one that feels that if you have the facts on your side, that you will eventually win out. And I mentioned some of them tonight, and Fred, you spoke to some, but golf's a $70 billion a year industry. It employs 2 million Americans. It generates almost $4 billion a year for charity, almost all of which goes to causes outside of the game of golf. It is played primarily on public facilities. 80% of the facilities in the United States are open to the public. It is affordable. The median green fee in the United States is $28. And I could go on, but the facts are that golf really is an egalitarian game if you look at it holistically. Now, are there courses that cost a significant amount of money to be a member of? Sure. And are there places where not everybody could become a member of a club if they wanted to? Sure, that's true. But those are the vast minority in terms of our game. But yet it persists in some quarters anyway, that's really the predominant part of the game. I mean, we just have to do a much better job of changing the perception of the game. I'll just give you one quick story to end on. Earlier this year, that illustrates this point. Earlier this year, we were in Washington, D.C. for National Golf Day. We have an initiative which is called We Are Golf, which is the industry's government relations initiative. And we had a meeting with the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, a fellow by the name of Mr. Dave Camp, fine fellow. And there was some legislation that was pending before that committee that would have been negative or injurious toward golf. Within 30 minutes after we had a chance just to explain to him just the basic elements of the game nationally and in his state, which is Michigan, he had a completely different view, so much so that he told us, and he made good on this assertion, that he was going to see to it that legislation did not go through, and it didn't. So my way of thinking is, if we can sit in the office of the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee and in 30 minutes convince him of the merits of golf, then I think we have a good chance of doing that almost with anyone. But it's just a lot of hard work. It's a lot of diligence, but we're up to the task, and we're going to stay after this.
And I think we are on the right path, and golf is getting great. And like we were mentioning also in the Par 5 News, new tournaments everywhere are going the game of golf in new countries as well, and that bodes well for the development of the game. So, Steve, thank you again for being with us and taking some time off your busy schedule. We always enjoy great, insightful information. So, we want to thank you for this great interview.
Okay,
Steve, thanks
Carlos.
A lot, sir. We'll talk to you down
thank
the road.
Thank you, Fred. Look forward to it. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Best of luck and best wishes in everything, all the endeavors of the World Golf Foundation. Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, gentlemen.
Well, there you have it. That was Steve Mona. He's the Chief Executive Officer of the World Golf Foundation. He was our VIG this week. Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, let's start our recaps from this weekend's action. So don't go away. We'll be right back.
Thank you for listening to the Back 9 Report presented by eDraft.com. We'll be right back. Don't forget to check out our co-hosts on Twitter by clicking their names in the episode description. Now, back to the show.
And we're back, and now it's time to start our recaps from this weekend's action. And let's start right away with the PGA Tour, and everybody knows what's going on, and that's the FedEx Cup. So last week, as you might all remember, Billy Horschel, he had a chance to come from behind and win the Deutsche Bank Championship, But then he hit that poor second shot that came up well short in the hazard. He ended 2 strokes off the pace at the TPC Boston. He quickly erased that disappointment of last week as he closed with a 1-under-69 on Sunday and won the BMW Championship by 2 strokes, ending his second tour title 14-under-par-266. Bubba Watson, he posted a 4-under-66 to end alone in second place at 12-under. Morgan Hoffman, he went crazy in the weekend. He shot 62 and 63 to soar into third place at 11-under. Sergio, again, you can just, this is just another trend. He led after 36 holes, but shot 3-under-67 on Sunday. He shared fourth place there at 9-under with Jim Furyk, Ryan Palmer, and Ricky Fowler. Rory McIlroy and Adam Scott, the top two players in the world rankings, both close with 66. They were joined at 8th place at 8-under-par by Jordan Spieth. And day after four-putting the 12th green for quadruple bogey, McIlroy four-putt the same green in the final round, this time for triple bogey.
He did what?
He did four-putt the same hole again for triple bogey.
Eight putts on 2 days? Eight putts on one hole?
Yeah, the same hole is the 12. He thought he had to play a par 12. And he was just trying to get there. So he was four now for the I believe that's what it was. I don't know what. Hey, Fred, there will officially be a new FedEx Cup champion this year after Henrik Stenson got eliminated with his T23 finish. Only two players move into the top 30 for this weekend's Tour Championship. Morgan Hoffman's solo third moves him up 47 spots, 68 to 21, and Ryan Palmer with the T4 moved up 14 spots from 37 to 23. So out from the top 30 were Stuart Appleby and Keegan Bradley, who finished 33rd from 28th after withdrawing on Saturday. Morning, let's start with this right now. We'll talk about this in depth later on. But he withdrew on Saturday morning, citing a potential rules infraction. Even though the PGA Tour Vice President of Rules and Competitions, Loggerwide, revisited Bradley's circumstances there at number 18, where Bradley identified what he thought was his block mark and absolved him of any potential violation. Anyway, his conscience, he said, no, I have to withdraw, so he did, and he became the third player to withdraw in the span of 2 days. Jason Day withdrew during the second round, citing a lower back strain. We all know he's been hurting all year long, but then came lefty Phil Mickelson. Just hours before Bradley, he withdrew before the third round because, how can I say this, he needed to rest. Anyway, he'll get his wish because he got eliminated as well. So Billy Horschel again, he won. He sprinted to victory. Did you see that sprint? He went crazy right away. I thought he was going to leave. You know, he looked like Forrest Gump on the 18, but he was just going to take a break. But he didn't
body
stop playing.
Body
he
break.
Won. Yes, yeah, it was a potty break, I know. But he looked like Forrest Gump. I thought he was just going to go away. Hey, great victory for him. $1.44 million for the victory and jumped from number 20 to number 2 in the FedEx Cup playoff standings.
Yeah, biggest story of the week, Carlos, is definitely the withdrawals of Mickelson, Bradley, and Day. We're going to talk about that more in depth in a little bit. Billy Horschel, biggest check of his career, $1.44 million. More importantly, as you say, moves up to number 2 in the FedEx Cup points list, has a real chance of winning the big check, the $10 million one. Chris Kirk leads the points list, but Horschel, Bubba Watson, Rory McIlroy, or Hunter Mahan are assured the big check and the FedEx Cup silver trophy if they should win at East Lake next week. Horschel won last year at the Zurich Classic. He finished inside the top 10 on 4 occasions this year and began the FedEx Cup playoffs at number 23 in the points list. Putting has been an issue for Horschel all season, but he found the greens at Cherry Hills much to his liking and made putts from everywhere. Kirk won the Deutsche Bank Championship, and Hunter Mahan won at their Barclays. Watson had a good year winning his second Masters, and Rory McIlroy was ranked number 1 in the FedEx Cup after his wins at the Open Championship, the WGC Bridgestone Invitational, and the PGA Championship consecutively. How about Morgan Hoffman, Carlos? You didn't mention Morgan Hoffman. He made the most fireworks at Cherry Hills last week after successive even par 70s on Thursday and Friday.
He fired an 8-under par 62 on Saturday to zoom up the leaderboard. He followed up his spectacular third round with a 7-under par 63 on Sunday to eventually finish third. He moved from number 68 all the way up to number 21 and punched his ticket for Atlanta. Bubba Watson was runner-up with Jim Furyk, Ricky Fowler, Sergio Garcia, and Ryan Palmer all finishing tied for fourth. Rory McIlroy and Jordan Spieth rounded out the top 10. If McIlroy, you know that feeling, Carlos, when you eat ice cream too fast and you get that brain freeze? I think that's what Rory was feeling on number 12 on Saturday and Sunday. Total brain freeze. If he could just have refrained from taking 8 putts in 2 days at the par 4 number 12, he would have finished a hell of a lot higher and been in better shape going into Atlanta. That's just real quick on the BMW. I could talk for a lot longer, but I know we ran over with the Steve Mona with the great information he had. So one more thing before I let you go. I want this gig. Okay, I really want this job. Dustin Johnson got the last spot in the Tour Championship. He finished number 30 in the FedEx Cup. But wait a minute. DJ has not hit a shot in the FedEx Cup playoffs, and he's at home or Lake Tahoe or somewhere playing with Paulina. Guess what, Carlos? He still gets the 175 foul from the FedEx Cup bonus pool. Where do I sign up for a gig like that? Don't even have to show up, and they send you 175 thou. That's a pretty good gig.
I won't comment. Otherwise, we'll be here.
You probably have
a
job like that, maybe. I don't know.
No, that's because I wish. So that's why I'm going to keep it that way, wishing. I'm not going to say a word about it. But anyway, let's talk about some other tournaments here in the U.S., and one of them was on the Web.com Tour that it's already playing the Web.com Tour Finals. Adam Hadwin closed with a 4-under 68 on Sunday. He rallied to win the Chiquita Classic. He won for the second time this season on the Web.com Tour, finished at 18-under par. He also won the Chile Classic earlier this season. John Peterson carded at 3-under 69 to grab second place at 16-under. Tom Hodge shot 4-under 68 and ended third at 15-under at River Run Country Club. Oscar Faustero, he fired a 6-under in the final round. He shared fourth place with Kyle Reifers, Jim Herman, and Scott Pinkey at 13-under. Third round leader Greg Chalmers, he faltered badly to a 3-over, and he ended alongside Colt Knost at 12-under. Hadwin earned $180,000 for the win to join Bob Cauley atop the Web.com Tour Final Series monolith. And the other tour playing in the U.S. is the Champions Tour. And West Short Jr., he fired. Yeah, Bernard Langer wasn't playing. Colin was in Europe, so that's why. Yeah, neither of them won. It was West Short Jr. who fired an 8-under 64 on Sunday. He came from behind to win the Quebec City Championship. He picked up his first Champions Tour title, ending at 15-under. He did win the 2013 Champions Tour Q School, but his last official victory was in the 2005 Michelin Championship at Las Vegas on the PGA Tour. So Scott Dunlap matched Short's 64, and he grabbed second place at 14-under. Second round co-leaders Brad Faxon and last year's winner and friend of the show, Steven Toledo, he posted matching 71s. They shared third place at 11-under. Kirk Triplett and Jim Carter were once took back at 10-under. David Frosty was joined in seventh play by Jay Haas and Lauren Roberts. West Shore Jr. earned $240,000 for the win, and he'll move inside the top 20 in the money list with the victory. So, Fred, some thoughts on those two tournaments?
Another Canadian, Adam Hadwin, forsaken hockey and will spend 2015 on the PGA Tour. His minus 18 for the week gave him the two-shot win over John Pederson. The Web.com Tour Finals are all about earning one of the 25 cards and increasing a player's priority ranking for the 2015 PGA Tour season. Carlos Ortiz has led the priority ranking all season, but Hadwin is putting pressure on him with his with this last win. With two events left in the Web.com Tour Finals series, the Nationwide Children's Hospital Championship this week and the Web.com Tour Championship at Sawgrass, the competition for these top spots is getting pretty exciting. As you mentioned, Wes Short Jr., he was the Champions Tour Q School medalist last year. Now he gets his first win on the Champions Tour. He posted one bird on the front nine on Sunday, but ran off five more plus an eagle at the last to post 29 on the backside for 64. That got him to minus 15 and gave him the one-shot win over Scott Dunlap. Dunlap, who won in Seattle just last month, and has five top 10 finishes in his first year on the Champions Tour, also shot 64 on Sunday with an eagle at the last hole. Must be an easy hole there at the last in Quebec. Friend of the show, as you mentioned, defending champion Esteban Toledo held a 36-hole lead with opening rounds of 68-66, but the 71 on Sunday, he fell down to third. Two-time U.S. Open champion Lee Jansen, playing in his first Champions Tour event, finished minus six for a T23 in his maiden voyage.
And that was a wrap-up on the U.S. Tours. Let's talk a little bit now on the European Tour side of the pond. So let's start with the European Tour, which played the Omega European Masters. David Levski, the American, he tapped in his three-foot putt par, and he won on the first playoff to defeat Graham Storm on the European Masters. And Sunday, he fired final round 5-under, while Storm carded a 2-under and the two finishing regulation on the Alpine course at Grand Sorcier at 18-under par. The win is the first for the American on the European Tour. Terrell Hatton, Brooks Koepka, who was near the top of the leaderboard all weekend, finished one stroke back in a tie for third at 17-under, while Danny Willett, who had the strong finish with a 63, and Tommy Fleetwood ended tie for fifth at 16-under. European Ryder Cup team member Jamie Donaldson, he settled for 15-under finish following his final 67, ended in sole possession for seventh place. The European Senior Tour, oh my God, Hikini is the Tour de Force, coming off a 10-shot victory at last week's Travis Perkins Masters. Calling Monty Montgomery, he fired a final round 7-under on Sunday to win the Russian Open Golf Championship by 3 strokes. Monty, who has now 4 wins this season and 5 victories in total on the European Senior Tour, finished a week at 14-under at Moscow Country Club. In Montgomery's last 5 events on tour, he has come away with 4 victories and a runner-up finish at the Senior Open Championship. Rick Gibson, he finished in sole possession of second place at 11-under. Andrew Alcorn and Barry Lane shot matching 68s, and they were 2 of 4 players to finish tied for third at 10-under. They were joined there by Miguel Angel Martin and Team Thelen. So Monty continues abusing the European Senior Tour. The Challenge Tour, the web.com store, homologo there in Europe, the Benjamin A. Bird, he shot a 4-under final round 66 on Sunday to take home a 3-shot victory at the Open Blue-Green called the Armour Breton. A. Bird, who has now won 5 times on the European Challenge Tour, finished the week at 15-under. A. Bird also won the Norwegian Challenge last month, so he's one of 2 players now looking to win the third there with Jake Roos. If they win the third, they'll be immediately promoted to the European Tour. Andrew MacArthur finishing sole possession, second place. They are 12-under. Paul Dwyer and they're in third at 10-under. And finally, the ladies European Tour, Dewey Claire Schiffel, she fired a final round of 6-under on Sunday, and she cruised to a 7-shot victory at the Helsingborg Open. Schiffel finished her week at the Vasatorp Golf Club at 17-under, well ahead of second place finisher, the defending champion, Rebecca Ortiz. The win is Schiffel's first on the Ladies European Tour. Rebecca Ortiz got in 71 in the final round to finish in second place at 10-under, while Laura Davis was right behind her at 9-under. She keeps playing well there. Valentin Deray ended 11 shots off the pace at 6 under, while Felicity Johnson and Lena Vedel finished tied for fifth. So, Fred, any tournaments?
Yeah, the Omega Masters on the European Tour at Crans-sur-Sierre Golf Club in Crans, Montana, Switzerland. I just love saying it. You know, you got to love it. Hey, it had an American feel, though. What's that?
Say it again.
The Crans-sur-Sierre Golf Club in Crans, Montana, Switzerland. I love that. It's always a pleasure to catch the outstanding views of the Alps from there. They are way up in those clouds there. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. Maybe if I live long enough, someday I'll get there to see it firsthand. Had an American feel, though. 26-year-old David Lipsky from the U.S. got his first European Tour victory in just his 18th European Tour start. He graduated from Northwestern University. That's Northwestern University in the Big Ten, Carlos. Same place Luke Donald went, and won the 2010 Big Ten Individual Championship. And he's been playing on the Asian Tour. He's the first player, member of the Asian Tour to win on the European Tour. Lipsky lives in L.A. We grew up there. He has a Jewish father and a Korean mother. So he is a true melting pot American. He now totals 428,000 Euros. He's number 51 in the race to Dubai, so he's going to get a nice bonus out of the bonus pool there, and he's inside now the top 150 in the Ohio official world golf rankings. He beats his previous best European Tour finish of tied second at the 2014 Championship at Laguna National earlier this season. And he becomes the ninth first-time winner on the European Tour this year. He becomes the first affiliate member to win on the European Tour since Tom Lewis at the 2011 Portugal Masters. And he began the final day three shots behind. He's the 21st winner to make up a deficit to finish to win. He becomes the first American to win the Omega European Masters since Craig Stadler in 1985. He's the third American to win on the European Tour this year. Patrick Reed had a win, of course, the Cadillac Championship, and Bubba won the Masters, which really are American tournaments, but who figures. He does gain the European Tour exemption until the end of 2016, and as I mentioned, it's his largest check on the European Tour. Now, also, did you happen to see the hole-in-one that Graham Storm had where he won the BMW i8, a nice little $130,000 car? Did you happen to see that?
No, I didn't get to see it.
It was really cool. He on the par three, I can't tell you which hole it was, but he knocks it up there. It takes about two bounces, goes in a hole. He throws up his arms, you know, he's excited, everybody. And then one of the caddies finally points out that he won the car that's sitting there, and then he really did get excited because that's a cool car. And also, on another note, what in the hell is going on with Kieran's good buddy, Colin Montgomery? I tell you what, he has found the fountain of youth. I want some of what that guy is drinking. I never imagined in my lifetime that I would be talking so much about Colin Montgomery. He wins in the U.S. He wins majors. He wins in Europe. He wins everywhere. Just spreads joy and lightness wherever he goes.
He has rejuvenated, like you say. Like you, I want some of it, at least half a cup. I don't know what he's doing, but I want to know his secret. Because he really is tearing up apart the European Senior Tour, and he's competing here in the U.S. toe-to-toe with Bernhard Langer. So, wow, what a great season. What a great time of his life Colin Montgomery is having. Well, Golfaholic fans, Back Niner fans, this wraps up our recaps for this weekend's action. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking something that I can't wait to start talking about. Let's take a short break.
Thank you for listening. We'll be right back. In the meantime, don't forget to visit www.edraft.com for analysis, breaking news, and more. Also, remember to follow us on Twitter at edraftsports and on Facebook at facebook.com/edraftsports. Now, back to the show.
And we're back, and now it's time to start our theme of the week. We're going to go to the practice range and take some shots. And this week, Fred, we're going to talk about withdrawals and not the ones that you think. We're going to talk, hey, I think, Fred, I'm about to call the CDC in Atlanta. They must intervene here with the PGA Tour because there's an epidemic trend and it's called withdrawals. Okay? I'm not going to mention any players. I'm not going to mention any names without knowing anything about any possible injury or illness status, okay? Nor will I implicate a player as part of any ploy to simply take his ball and go home, cutting his losses after a round that included two double bogeys on the first four holes, a quintuple bogey in the sixth, or maybe a career worse from nine. But when you see a player, not this week, let's go a little back, say like May or something like that, signed for an 8 over 80, the highest score during the first round of a tournament in Houston, and I'm not mentioning any names, then he withdraws from the tournament without an immediate reason, then you have to start seeing that wasn't the first time this happens, and you start guessing, hey, when anybody shoots now 80, now they can withdraw and come up with an excuse or an injury. That part of the problem is lying right now within the current PGA Tour rules. The competitors who withdraw right now during a tournament round must eventually, not immediately, eventually provide a valid medical excuse. Those who withdraw after posting the score need no explanation. Okay, in a way, it's much like another hot button issue of slow plays. If there's no direct penalty and other than fines and warnings, there hasn't been one for slow play nearly two full decades, then there's no motivation for the players to avoid it. We all remember the Toothgate incident last year when Rory McIlroy, already 7-under, started mentioning names, and short missed the cut, he walked off the course midway through last year's on the Classic. Second round, he cited then a toothache. You all remember Bubba Watson, and I keep mentioning names I said I wasn't going to. He blamed his allergies as his reason for withdrawing from the Arnold Palmer Invitational when he followed an opening round of 83. He was trailing by 15 strokes when he made his decision on Thursday. He wasn't required to provide a reason because he finished the round. But there was an update to that story because on Friday morning, his agent, David Winkle, he texted, "I was just a little stiffness in his back, nothing serious, just being careful." So he's ready to roll next week. So the underlying effect is that it harms the tournament host. It may hurt the tour a little with this withdrawals, but it hurts the title sponsor, the local fans, even more because especially if you're a big draw for the event, which is the ones that get the most attention, hey, the fans suffer. They came to see you. They bought the tickets. They paid for it. They're here. So the problem here, of course, is that nobody besides the player understands his level of pain or discomfort. So you got to feel somehow like, oh, maybe it's true, or is it, but it's so complicated because then you see that they shoot this 80s, 83s or something like that, and they withdraw, and you think, is it true or not what they're doing? So while it might look suspicious on the surface, the devil's advocate may contend that it could prove to be the right move for them. However, without a rule in place requiring medical explanation for post-round withdrawal, the PGA Tour is basically issuing a bottomless get-out-of-jail-free card. So, Fred, the current policy leaves plenty of room for doubt right now. We can impugn players for a perceived lack of effort, but maintain that any are faking the symptoms is a weighty accusation. So you're in the middle of this, so what's your take on it?
Well, you know, this is a multi-pronged problem, Carlos, and it's not – you know, we kind of notice it more now because we're paying a little bit more attention to it. But there have been withdrawals going back to the, you know, 20s and 30s and 40s. You know, if a guy wasn't playing good, didn't have a chance to finish in the top 10 or top 20, He simply didn't. He just quit and got in a money game with some members or something back in the 40s. He didn't go out and try to make 50 bucks. He went out and tried to make a couple hundred off of a member. You know, it's a little different today. They're playing for a lot more money. They have a lot of money in their pocket. Most of them do. So they maybe need to conserve their energy. But anyway, we had three marquee names withdraw from the BMW Championship last week. Of course, Phil Mickelson, Keegan Bradley, and Jason Day. After a season that began with such promise and a win at the WGC Accenture Match Play, Day has battled injuries all summer, all season. First his thumb, and now a back problem is putting him on the bench. Keegan Bradley had a rules issue. You know, Phil was out of contention, couldn't make it to Atlanta after a poor second round, and was just plain tired. So he jumped on the jet, said, "See you later. I'm going home to Amy and the kids." Scooted on off. From a PR standpoint, Phil didn't handle his withdrawal very well. It was almost as if he was trying to make a statement to the PGA Tour, as he has kind of want to do over the years. In Keegan's case, he did take the high road and ended up costing himself a lot of money in the process. You know, he gave away at least $50,000 in bonus pool money. That's the minimum, and it could be a couple hundred thousand dollars. And he gave away at least $150,000 of purse money for that's what you know the 30th place is going to pay. So he gave away $300,000 by withdrawing just because he felt bad about the situation. Phil has said the reason he left: "My primary goal is to rest and prepare for the Ryder Cup. Without a chance to contend at the Tour Championship, the most important thing for me now is to prepare for the Ryder Cup. With no wins in 2014, only one top 10 finish, a runner-up at the PGA Championship, Mickelson puts an end to his poorest season since joining the Tour in 1994. It was just the third season in his 23-year career he has failed to win a title on the PGA Tour." And really, winning at the Tour Championship is about the only salvation that he can have for this season, other than having a really going 5-0 or 6-0 or whatever at the Ryder Cup. But he was 14 strokes behind tournament leader Sergio Garcia, and he needed a top four finish to advance in the FedEx Cup playoffs. And so he just said, "Bye bye, see ya, fire up the jet, let's boogie." Keegan Bradley was a little different. He said, "I just feel withdrawing is the right thing to do to protect the field in the BMW Championship and the Tour Championship next week. It's eating me alive. I didn't call my fellow competitors for help in the first place, and that bothers me. I know the official approved the drop, but I just can't be absolutely sure if it was the right spot." You know, he had sought out Slugger White for clarification, and Slugger said, "You did nothing wrong. It's okay." But Keegan just couldn't live with himself, so he went ahead and withdrew. Carlos, it's a long season. But you know what? 16 NFL football games in 18 weeks is a long season. 84 NBA basketball games or 162 Major League Baseball games is a long season. 41 regular season events plus 4 FedEx Cup playoff events makes a long season, but there's so much concentrated into these last few weeks. And the other thing is there's just no real fall break anymore. The season begins in early October with 6 events, and that count to the 2015 FedEx Cup points. The compression of big purse events from the Open Championship in July to the Tour Championship here at the end of the FedEx Cup playoffs is very tiring and a strain on the players this time of year. The money is so huge, $67 million being split up over just these 4 weeks of the FedEx Cup playoffs. Players have to put themselves into position to maximize their percentage of that number. They're doing this for a job. They're doing this to make money. The total purse available on the PGA Tour was over $335 million last year. You never know when your last swing will come, so players are forced to push their bodies to the maximum to earn every dollar possible. You know, and this is really no different than it's ever been for any professional athlete.
you know, you can think of Mickey Mantle hobbling around on crippled knees the last couple of years he played, trying to get every last game out of his weary body, or Willie Mays or even Michael Jordan playing much longer than they should have. Few professional athletes leave the game on their own terms. Age, injury, quicker, faster, younger athletes take their place, or their body just refuses to perform at a level that will allow them to compete. You know, we're seeing the aging of a couple of golf's greatest competitors, Phil Mickelson and Tiger Woods. It's happening right before our eyes. It's not pretty, but it's the survival of the jungle. Mickelson, now 44, dealing with psoriatic arthritis. Woods will be 38 at the end of December. With his back and knees and whatever else is ailing him, you know, it's really cutting his competitive years shorter. After a 5-win season last year, everyone wanted to see Woods contend in the majors this year. You know, there's money available. The sponsors are putting up big dollars, and it's the PGA Tour's job, sole purpose, to use that money and hold tournaments for their member players. The PGA commissioner reminded us today in his press conference that the players are independent contractors and set their own schedule. If they want to play, they play. If they don't want to play, they don't play. We have seen Woods play an abbreviated schedule for years. Steve Stricker did it last year, and Bruce Litsky did it to perfection in the 80s. The only mandate on the PGA Tour is a player must enter 15 events in a calendar year. That should not be too difficult with 45 tournaments. It's only 33% of them, one out of every three. The real problem is the travel, the corporate sponsor requirements that they must do, and the massive amount of money available. $6 million purses are the norm, with $8 million each for the four FedEx Cup playoff events and $10 million this year for the players and the PGA Championship. The break between seasons after the FedEx Cup and before the fries.com at the beginning of October, with the Ryder Cup squeezed in, is more of a TV timeout rather than a break. You know, and then the European Tour players will even travel around the world in November, December and try to maximize earnings on the race to Dubai. You know, we've seen Luke Donald and Rory McIlroy win the multi titles of both European and PGA Tours the last few years. We saw Henrik Stenson win the FedEx Cup and the race to Dubai last year. So as the athletes get bigger, stronger, and faster, athletes are able to swing the club harder and faster, putting more stress on joints and muscles. Tendons, ligaments are strained to keep everything in place. Without proper rest and nutrition, the body breaks down. Golf courses are longer, requiring harder swings. Equipment will respond better with higher swing speeds. If we still had persimmon and balata balls, they'd have to swing easier because the ball would just go out in outer space. You know, it'd go 50 yards away. And the rough keeps getting bigger. So it's a vicious cycle. Guys keep getting hurt. They keep getting tired. They're trying to play more. The difficulty for a professional athlete is to maintain a healthy body, and we'll probably see more withdrawals when nothing is on the line. Phil Mickelson had nothing on the line this week. He wasn't going to make it to Atlanta. He was tired from all the travel and all the play since the Open Championship. He's had a rough year. And on top of it all, he had the problem with the SEC breathing down his neck. So, you know, it's not fun as a golf fan to see these guys withdraw, but I certainly understand it. And as there's more and more tournaments and more demands on these guys, we're going to see more and more of it, Carlos.
I do understand all that. And that's why I say that there's a difficulty because of all those that many tournaments, like you mentioned. Right now, some players play 8 of 10 weeks. Some will play 6 of 7. Like you mentioned, the new wraparound season, the tour has events during 43 weeks of the 52 in a year right now. Throw in there as well the Ryder Cup or the President's Cup, depending on the year. We'll challenge that benefits Tiger Woods Foundation. There's also the Franklin Templeton Shootout, ASBS and World Cup. That's a lot of tournaments. But as well, like you mentioned, there's the other side of the coin. Tiger Woods and Steve Stricker have played limited schedules. So to me, yes, that's the problem because you have the sponsors and all the corporations behind you sponsoring that want you to play. But there's some kind of a trend. I mean, you don't want to be called a quitter. But that's what it sounds like when you just take off like you did, like Phil Mickelson did. Nobody is forcing him. If you're tired, hey, don't play anyway. If you thought you were not going to make it, don't play at all. Hey, take 3 weeks instead of two. Okay, I know there's a lot of problems with all the contiguous tournaments. 4 weeks, then Fincham says it's not going to happen in the future. But it doesn't help anyway. That's just a FedEx Cup. There's still 43 of 52 weeks where tournaments are there. So players have to be wiser as well. And I think it affects the fans when you're a big draw like Phil Mickelson, like Bo Watson, Dustin Johnson, all those big players that have lately withdraw, you know, just can't allow it. There has to be something of a fine or something. I don't believe in the medical excuse because these people have so much money, they just can go to any doctor. Hey, give me that medical excuse. Maybe have an independent doctor to certify that he really is injured or something like that. But I'm in the middle of it. I don't believe that all of those excuses that they do bring out there is true. I just think that there's too much of a coincidence that it happens exactly when you're over 80, 39, you're just gone away, and then you start, you know, oh, my neck is hurting or my elbow. Then all of a sudden, the next week, you just come out and play great. So I think there's a little bit of both right on this.
Well, you know, the other side of that, Carlos, is do you really you want to see the big names play, but do you want to see them play poorly? Not really. You know, I don't want to see Tiger Woods, Phil Mickelson shoot 80, 79. I don't want to see that. I want to see him shooting, you know, 68, 67. If they're out of contention and you're forcing them to play, they're not going to play that good. Their heart's not going to be in it. They're just going to be putting in their time and boogieing anyhow. So, I just don't get it. If they don't want to play, you know, they're forfeiting the money. They're the one that's walking away from it. So it's hurting their pocketbook. Nobody else's. They're independent contractors, Carlos. They're, you know, it's up to them. They're playing for themselves and their families. So, you know, I don't think it's a problem. There's enough good players. You know, Fincham said today, you know, when he first started, you know, Jack Nicklaus wasn't playing anymore, you know, in 96, you know, 94, I guess it was, pre-Tiger. And, you know, how are you going to make the tour successful without a marquee name? And you know, the tour did pretty good. It kept growing. And then along came Tiger, and it really grew. Now they're back to where there's a lot of young guys and there's a lot of interest in the young guys, Ricky Fowlers and Billy Horschels and guys like that. The tour will live. It's not dependent on one guy. If a couple guys want to take the week off or withdraw and they're not playing well, they don't feel right, you know, go on home. I just agree with them, I guess.
I understand, and I know that golf is hard. There will be plenty of bad days for everybody. One day will be great. The other one can be bad. So sticking it out could mean more to them in the long run if they're really injured. Hey, if they're hurt or hurt yourself in the course, by all means, everybody, get out of there as quick as possible. But it's just something that is happening so often when the round starts to balloon that it's just getting easy out for them. I think there should be at least some accountability for it, because that way you will really make them play. It doesn't matter. I mean, there was, if you might remember, on the Classic, Brendan DeJonge, he started great with the 66-64, then he suffered that painful rib injury and led to the 76-78. But, hey, he did finish. Yeah, it could have been either way. Hey, he was dumb to finish it, or he was courageous to finish it. But he was there, and he finished it. So, hey, you can have a bad day. And, of course, a wise man then said, hey, you know, you can lose, you know, the tournament right away on Thursday. You're not going to win it on Sunday, but you definitely can win it. You can lose it on Thursday. But, hey, anything can happen in golf. The ball is round, and it can go either way.
Yeah, looks like we're not going to agree on this one, but I'm sure we'll discuss this.
We're not agreeing?
I'm sure we'll discuss it some more, and I'm sure we're going to see more withdrawals going forward.
Yeah, I hope the quitting finishes. To me, that's what's happening. Anyway, we're going to agree to disagree one of the few times we do here in the show. So, hey, let's take a short break, and when we come back, let's do our previews for this weekend's action. So don't go away, anybody. We'll be right back.
Thank you for listening. We'll be right back. In the meantime, don't forget to visit www.edraft.com for analysis, breaking news, and more. Also, remember to follow us on Twitter at edraftsports and on Facebook at facebook.com/edraftsports. Don't forget to check out our co-hosts on Twitter by clicking their names in the episode description. Now, back to the show.
And we're back, and now let's start our previews for this weekend's action. Let's start right away with the PGA Tour finale, okay? It wraps up its season and the FedEx Cup playoffs, as the Cup will be decided this week at the Tour Championship by Coca-Cola at East Lake in Georgia. Chris Kirk Lee hits the standings right now, but any of the top five will take the FedEx Cup if they win at East Lake. The five men who will take the Cup and the $10 million bonus prize with the victory at the Tour Championship could be Chris Kirk, Billy Horschel, Bubba Watson, Rory McIlroy, and Hunter Mahan. There will be also just 29 players at East Week this week instead of 30. Dustin Johnson, like you mentioned, he ended 30th on the 30 the points list without shooting a stroke. Okay, he didn't do anything. He's on extended leave from the tour and will not compete. But any of the 29 players on the list that start have a theoretical chance of victory. Even Gary Woodland, who qualified 29, he could take the FedEx Cup, but it would take a mathematical magician to explain how he can do it. So I'm not one of them, so I'm not going to explain it. Of the seven past FedEx Cup champions, only Bill Hasson, free Jim Furyk in the field. Also in the field is Hunter Mahan, the only player to compete in every FedEx Cup playoff event since the playoff started. There's no cut to worry about the 29 men teeing it up this week. And all of those in the field know they will be exempt for the first three majors next year. So, Fred, for the fifth time in 6 years, the reigning champion failed to make it back to East Lake the following year. How about the season finale for the FedEx Cup and the PGA Tour?
Yeah, they're at East Lake Country Club, the home course of Bobby Jones and the oldest golf course in Atlanta. The course has done a tremendous job of improving the urban area surrounding the course over the past several years, and the Tour Championship has been played there every year since 2004. The course was originally built by the Atlanta Athletic Club, which first purchased the ground in 1898. You remember that, Carlos. The first seven holes opened in 1906, and a full 18 was opened for play in 1907. Donald Ross did a redesign in 1913, and Reese Jones restored Ross's original design in 1994. And this is the course that we see today. It's 7,154 yards, a par 70, and something a little different. It finishes with a par 3 on the 18th hole. As you mentioned, there's only 29 players there this week. Dustin Johnson is not competing. There's no rule for substituting taking his place. So number 31, Stuart Appleby, doesn't get to play. You've got, of course, $8 million purse. After it's all said and done, the $35 million FedEx Cup bonus pool is going to be divided up, of which $10 million goes to the winner. The other $25 million gets split between the top 150 golfers proportionally on down the line. The money is so big, and the thing that you mentioned, that every player that's in the top 30 earns an exemption into three of the major championships next year. And Jeff Ogilvy, who kind of slid in the back door into the playoffs, very tired. You know, it's just a lot of golf at the end of the year, like we were talking about earlier. And He was not excited about playing, but he is excited about getting the three major championship exemptions. So that's just all part of it. The guys, you know, I'm sure they're tired. I'm sure they're ready for the season to end and get home for some R&R or to the lake or wherever they're going to go. But one more week of it, guys, and there's a lot of rewards awaiting these 30 guys, 29 guys, I should say.
A million reasons they have to try to slug it out one more week. 10 million reasons. So let's see. Very, very interesting, that finish for the FedEx Cup. There's a major coming because there's after one week break, the LPGA is going to resume its schedule this week as they head to France for the Evian Championship. This is the LPGA's fifth and final major championship of the year. The Evian Championship was founded in 1994 on the Ladies European Tour as the Evian Masters. It's one of two major championships on the LAT Tour. It became an LPGA LET co-sanctioned event in 2000. July 2011, it was announced that beginning last year, the Evian Masters would be renamed the Evian Championship and would become the fifth major on the LPGA Tour schedule. The course for the tournament is the Evian Masters course in Evian-le-Bain in France at the Evian Resort Club. The talent in this field is amazing, which makes it hard to predict who will come out on top. 47 of the top 50 players on the LPGA priority to the list and 35 of the top 40 on the Rolex rankings will be in attendance. Suzanne Pedersen, she's the defending champion, and she's also close to being on form. One that is back in top form, and that's definite, it's in Bay Park. She's riding her return to top form and is looking to start a new streak in the majors as she goes for two in a row. She's one of three winners, major winners this season that are in the field this week. Lexi Thompson, who won the Kraft Nabisco, Michelle Wee, the U.S. Women's Open, are the other two, while the Women's British Open champ Mo Martin is missing the event. Many of the LPGA players have taken time off to prepare for this tournament. Some took time off to allow their respective injuries to heal, while others just simply needed to rest to work on their games. The world's number one, Stacey Lewis, was one of those who needed a break, while Michelle Wee will be making her first start since a finger injury knocked her out of competition at the major LPGA Classic in August. On a special note, like we mentioned before in the Bar 5 News, Australian Min Jae Lee just turned pro and will compete this week as a sponsor invitee. Including in the field will be many non-LPGA members who are high up in the Rolex rankings, like Hayu Kim, Hannah Yang, Charlie Hall, In Jae Chun, Sakura Yagamine, Gladys Noceda, and Nikki Campbell. Also worth noting are the presence of the 2014 U.S. Women's Amateur Champion Kristen Gilman and the 2014 British Ladies Amateur Champion Emily K. Peterson. Are worth noting they will be fighting for the top amateur honors spot.
Yeah, also coming out of this, it's the final major, of course, for the LPGA season, and the final major in golf is the inaugural Rolex Annika Major Award to be cited at the after this week. The winners of the major championships, Lexi, Michelle, Mo Martin, and NB, who's gonna win that award, depending on how they finish this week. Peterson looks to defend. She's not had that great a run in the majors this year. Although I think she did finish runner-up at the British Open, maybe? Yep, British Open, British Women's Open. Michelle Wee returns action this week, as you mentioned. We haven't seen her for a month or so. Envy's going for two in a row. She won the last time out. Lydia Ko, with sore hand and all, is going to try and still win a major as a rookie. She's still number three in the world, and she's had two full weeks to rest, so she's ready to go. Couple things here. The purse is $3.25 million. The winner gets $487,000, so this is a big deal for the women. This is a big purse for them. TV times. Starting on September the 11th at 7:30 a.m. to 12:30 a.m., and they run pretty much in the morning 6:30 a.m. to noon, 8:30 till noon, all the way through. And on Sunday, they're going from noon to 1:30. So try and catch some of that from Evian, from France, on the southern banks of Lake Geneva, beautiful Lake Geneva.
Oh, yeah, Evian Pain Le Pons there in France, Evian. So beautiful, beautiful sighting. At least that's what I have seen from the pictures, because I haven't been there. Wish I could be there. But anyway, it's going to be the fifth and final major for the LPGA. Very interesting, amazing field has gathered there this weekend. The Web.com Tour is in Ohio. In Ohio, Fred. Why?
Center of the golf universe.
There it is. They're there this week for the third event of the final series. That's the Nationwide Children's Hospitals Championship. The tournament is the third of four in the series, limited to the top 75 players from the Web.com Tour money list and numbers 126 to 200 in the PGA Tour's FedEx Cup standings. The top 25 on the Web.com money list have earned PGA Tour cards. They're competing against each other for the PGA Tour priority, with regular season earnings counting in their totals and their final leader getting a spot in the Players' Championship. The other players are fighting for another 25 cards based on their earnings in the series. PGA Tour player Bob Cauley won the series opening event in Fort Wayne, Indiana, while Web.com Tour's player Adam Hadwin won last weekend in the Chiquita Classic in Davidson, North Carolina, for his second victory of the year, and is closing in on Carlos Ortiz. He's playing for PGA Tour priority after earning a card with a fourth-place finish on the Web.com Tour's regular season money list. So how about the third right there, almost in the near backyard? No, not so, not quite. But the Nationwide Children's Hospital Championship that's going to be played at the Ohio State University Golf Course in Columbus, Ohio. Right.
Oh, Carlos, a place near and dear to my heart, the Scarlet Course at the Ohio State University Golf Club. Original Alistair McKenzie design. It was renovated by Jack Nicklaus in 2005. It's long, demanding. It's beautifully laid out. It's not a tricky golf course. Water comes into play on only about three holes, but it proves to be all the players want to handle every year. Nationwide Insurance and Columbus area do an excellent job of hosting this event each year. Always nice crowds turn out. It's a very golf-savvy community, and, you know, with Muirfield Village and the memorial there every year, and now the, you know, and then with this big tournament there in here in actually football season now, maybe somebody's looking for a diversion. The Buckeyes lost last week, so they're off to a bad start, so maybe more people will come out to the golf course. We're going to see if Carlos Ortiz can maintain his number one priority ranking heading to the 2015 PGA Tour, and only two events remain this week in the Web.com Tour Finals with the Nationwide Children's Hospital Championship this week and then the Tour Championship next week at Sawgrass. Who's going to punch their ticket? Who's going to jump up? Is anybody going to come from way down and jump up or push somebody else out of, you know, the 25 cards have already been given. 25 cards are up for grabs. And also, guys are looking to improve their priority ranking heading into the start of the 2015 season at theprize.com in about a month's time. So that's about all I have on that, Carlos.
Okay, and let's move on to the other tournament, big tournament in the European Tour this time that heads for Holland this week and the KLM Open at Kennemerick Golf and Country Club in Zandvoort. The home player, Juus Luyten, he's the defending champion in this prestigious tournament. Luyten, he's obviously the local favorite. He was a playoff winner last year over Miguel Angel Jimenez, golf's most interesting man. And after narrowly missing his first Ryder Cup team, the Dutchman, he's back this week to defend his title. His countryman, Robert Jan Thurksen, will be playing his 20th KLM Open and likely his last, as he announced earlier this year that this will be his final season on tour. Luyten is joined on the start sheet by major champs Darren Clark, Patty Harrington, Paul Laurie, and Jose Maria Alzavo. Italy's Matteo Manassero will tee it up. So too Paul Casey, Robert Charlson, last week's European Masters winner, David Lipsky. Also, Simon Dyson is looking for four. He has some success here, three times already a winner. So how about the KLM Open and the European Tour for it?
Carlos, I don't have a lot for you on the European Tour. I know Dirksen is going to retire. He's been around for a long time. I'm sorry, Carlos, but I don't have much for you for this one.
This is my bad. I thought it was another tournament. But I threw it back at you there. So anyway, there are some other tournaments. Minor tournaments, there's actually and the regional tours. The European Senior Tour has the Portugal Senior Open. It's at the Vidago Palace in Portugal. The International Golf Federation has the World Amateur Team Championship. This is talking about the men's. They're going to play at the Karuizawa 72nd Golf East Tide and Aniriyama courses in Karuizawa in Japan. The U.S. Golf Association has the U.S. Mid-Amateur Championships, and that is going to be from the Saucon Valley Country Club Old Course in Bethlehem in Pennsylvania. The PGA Tour Canada has the Tour Championship of Canada. It's going to be played at the Sunningdale Golf and Country Club in London, Ontario. The Asian Tour has the Yinder Tournament Players Championship from the Linkou International Golf and Country Club in Taipei, in Taiwan. PGA Tour of Australasia has the South Pacific Open Championship that's going to be played at the Tina Golf Club in Noumea, New Caledonia. The eGolf Professional Tour, there's a lot of action. And the Highland View Casino Championship from the Windham's Country Club in Gulfport, Mississippi. And the women have the U.S. Golf Association has the U.S. Women's Mid-Amateur Championship from the Harbor Trees Golf Club in Noblesville, Indiana, the Sinatra Tour, the Garden City Charity Classic. That's going to be from the Buffalo Duns Golf Club in Garden City, Kansas. And the Japan LPGA Tour has the JLPGA Championship, Konica Minota Cup. It's going to be played from the Minagi Golf Club in Hyogo, Japan. And since we have a little bit of a time, we have a little bit more over 3 minutes, I'm going to go right over the birthdays. I just want to go out with tomorrow. Arnold Daniel Palmer will turn 85, the king. He's going to turn 85. Larry Nelson, three-time major winner, 67. And a friend of the show, happy birthday to him, Esteban Toledo. He's going to turn 52 tomorrow. On the 11th, on Thursday, Jeff Lumen will turn 57. He's Jeffrey George Lumen. David Frost, 55, and that's on Thursday. On Friday, two players turn 45, Angel Cabrera and Shigeki Maruyama. And on Saturday, Mark Charles Wiebe will turn 57. So happy birthday to all of them. Fred, we have a little bit of time, just over 2 minutes. Some final quick thoughts before we let everyone go.
Yeah, I really enjoyed talking with Steve Mona this evening. He is such a wealth of knowledge. He has the numbers. He's right in the middle of what's going on in the world of golf, what the top managers, the top executives are looking at, thinking about, considering, USGA, PGA, PGA Tour. All those guys are right there, and he interacts with those guys on a daily basis. So always good to listen to him, and I'm going to have to listen back to some of the things that he said because I was making some notes, but, man, he was throwing some good stuff out there.
Always insightful, really enjoyable. If you missed it, listen back to us here on Blog Talk Radio or on TuneIn. We're also on TuneIn. So Back Nine Report, friends, that wraps up another week of the Back Nine Report presented by eCraft.com. It's our pleasure to bring you the latest on the world of golf. Special thanks to our VIG, very important guest of the week, Steve Mona. He took great time off his busy schedule to give us another very insightful and enjoyable interview. Don't forget to join us again next week, Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, here on Block Talk Radio and also through TuneIn. Go there, follow the show if you haven't done so. Also on Twitter, our ID is at Back9Report with the number 9 in the middle. My name is Carlos Torres, along with Fred Albader. Be happy, be blessed, and enjoy a great game of golf. Happy golfing, everybody.
Good night, everybody.